So we, you guys talked a lot during the coffee break. So we've got about 10 minutes. Should we have 5 minutes where you discuss at your tables, or would you like to just present questions and comments now? I'm just sort of asking. Sure. So questions now then? Is that fair? Okay. Come on back up. So just raise your hand and we'll come around to get you.
No one over here?
Hi. One question I have is, whenever I try to promote public transit or talking to people that are biking, it's, but it's cold in Canada. We can't do that. So how do you combat that argument?
We're Danes, not Italians. Same argument. One of the things we run into, without getting too philosophical about it, is one of the things you notice when you spend, I've wound up spending quite a lot of time in Denmark doing the kind of research I do, and because Denmark's pretty monocultural, or has been for most of its history, there are great deep cultural traditions about dealing with the cold. Danes are not in denial about the fact that they live in a cold climate. Canadians, to some degree, I would argue, particularly in cities, remain in deep denial of the fact of the cold. Calgary is a terrific example of this. Lots and lots of people in Calgary get in their heated garage, turn the car on, drive to a heated parking garage in an office building, and then move from office building to office building in plus 15 tunnels, and never breathe a breath of fresh air the entire summer or the entire winter. And then when they actually do go outside, they're not dressed for it, so it's, my God, it's way too cold to be outside. The argument I would make is that if you look, let's just use the example of biking. The world's premier biking cities are Amsterdam, which is a little bit more maritime than us. Copenhagen at around zero, I promise you, is at least as cold as an Alberta city at minus 15, if not more so. It's a vicious, cutting kind of cold. It's darker there as well. They don't get near as much sunshine as we do in Alberta. If you look at cities where they've seen really great growth in cycling in the United States, two of the leaders are Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Portland, Oregon, neither of which are bright, sunny summer cities. What we have found time and again is that, you know, much as I hate to use the cliche, if you build it, they do in fact come. If the infrastructure is good, if it is a convenient way to get around, people will use more transit, they will walk more, they will bike more. One of the examples I often use when I'm talking about transit specifically is just to show pictures of some of the bus stops in Calgary. There's one in particular I always show the picture of where it's basically a dirt square with a bench next to it, right next to the roadway. Where there's no, like, the sidewalk, to get from the sidewalk to the dirt square, you would have to go through snow half the year. And then you're sitting right next to the place where the slush and everything gathers, and you'd be splashed constantly. We've built these systems to fail, and so they fail. And so if you look at any city in any culture or climate where they've built the right infrastructure, people have adopted it. I would highly recommend reading some of Jan Gehl's books on this subject. Jan Gehl, one of the things he talks about is, I mean, he's you know, Copenhagen guy, has consulted around the world. He says, even when I consult to another Scandinavian city, the first thing they will tell me after the first meeting, someone will pull me aside and say, you don't understand, we need our cars here, it's different here. And every single time he finds that once you change the nature of the street, once you build the right kind of infrastructure, people use it. I mean, we take our cue from the landscape. One of the things we're seeing now, which does, amazingly enough, I've been at this for a few years now, the one thing that seems to have defeated or begun to defeat the it's too cold in Canada argument is, weirdly enough, the rise of smartphone use. Almost every single urban design type conversation I've had over the last couple of years has been a room full of people obsessed with the fact that young people aren't driving as much as before, waiting longer to get their driver's licenses, not as interested in it, and one of the big reasons for that is because they'd rather be able to communicate along the way than be stuck, you know, piloting their own vehicle. Whether or not that's a long-term trend, it's opened the door a wedge enough that you can get your foot in and carry on the argument that way. But basically, you know, it does come back to human nature. We've built a system that rewards you at every turn for driving, so it's not surprising that we think that that's the only way we can get around.
Thank you very much for all your excellent points in your talk. I have to listen real fast to keep up, but I appreciate your comments about the neighborhoods and you could call it the New Urban Movement. Design the cities to be more pedestrian friendly, bike friendly. Thanks for your comment about high speed train. I've been kind of thinking for a few years if the first high speed rail is not even in Calgary, we should all be ashamed of ourselves. Because it makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering if, coming back to the urbanist movement, if you're familiar with James Fox, and so in honor of James Jacobs, world renowned urbanist author and community involvement organizer. I guess we're going to be organizing one in Lac-a-Wish this coming May. And it seems to me that it fits very well with walkable neighborhoods, alternatives to automobile traffic. So,
I'm very familiar with them. I've been on a couple. Actually, my wife at the back of the room led one in the neighborhood in Calgary she grew up in. Only one person showed up, but they had a great time. They're fantastic things. If everyone's not familiar with Jane Jacobs, one way to think about her is as the kind of great philosopher of an urban land ethic. Jane Jacobs basically, you know, wrote a book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities that looked at the kind of natural ecology of cities, how they grow, how they prosper, how they fail, how people use the space, what spaces work and what don't. And along the way, she got involved in a number of very, very high-profile movements against automobile infrastructure, first in New York and then in Toronto. To stop the building of huge expressways right in the middle of well-loved, well-used, historic downtown neighborhoods, and eventually went on to basically be kind of the godmother of modern urbanism. Jane's walks are a fantastic thing. Even if you live in a community that is not yet walkable, it's a great way to get intimately familiar at that pedestrian level with what you've got there. And they take all different forms. Sometimes it's very much focused on urban design and these sorts of issues. Sometimes it's very historical, looking at what used to be there and why the street is shaped this way and not that way and why the angles meet the way they do. But they're a fantastic thing. I think a huge benefit to any community. And they're always done, is it the first weekend of June? That's it.
Of May.
Of May, yeah. So if you hear about a James Walk, or if your community doesn't have one, organizing one is a great way to get people talking and thinking about the kind of space you want to live in and be in. And if you're not already familiar with her work, definitely check out Jane Jacobs' writing. Her most recent book, finished shortly before she died, is called Dark Age Ahead. And it's well worth reading, even though, obviously, with the title Dark Age Ahead, it's not the cheeriest read. But it is actually well worth reading. What she basically talks about, interestingly enough, and I think it's a good corollary to the conversations we've had today about land ethics. When she's talking about a dark age, she's mainly talking about the collective memory of societies and the way that an enormous amount of how we build and operate societies, and you know, agriculture is a great example of it, is wisdom passed down from generation to generation. And she talks a lot about what happens when societies lose that, when we get so disconnected from our past that we lose that, you know, all that vital knowledge about, you know, how you're good stewards on the land, how you build a good community, how you build a street that people want to spend time on. And so it would be, you know, I think a great complimentary read to the conversation you've had today as an introduction to her work.
So we'll just take one more question here. I think there's a great context to bring it into the urban setting after the more rural setting this morning. I was wondering if you think there are different kinds of land ethics. Is the land ethic on the land are they different in any way?
Well, I would say, first of all, they're deeply interconnected. There is no us or them in that. It's as deeply interconnected as any of the systems are interconnected on their own. So, you know, there is no city without a huge rural catchment to feed it in 100 different ways, 1,000 different ways. Not just food, but you know, water and space and all manner of other natural services. I think the sense of connection to the land, as we normally think of it, tends to be stronger in rural environments simply because it's more immediately applicable. And one of the things we talk often about is this idea of urban or suburban disconnectedness, that you don't have that sense of actual connection to the place you're in. I think that's less likely to happen in rural environments. For example, you don't see the thing, you know, which you do increasingly see in some suburban environments where there's extraordinarily little actual activity in outdoors in public space, in part because there aren't that many left, but, you know, like where kids, most of their playtime is in indoor environments or structured play environments and not just, you know, sort of exploring the world on their own and learning all the vital skills that we know they learn there. That said, I think that there are common challenges and common successes that we can share. You know, basically things like dependency on internal combustion engines is, if anything, stronger in rural environments than urban ones. The use of space, the use of public space, I think that there are similar kinds of challenges in small communities as there are in large ones. They're just different in scale. I think more than anything, what we need to be doing is building bridges so that we can learn from each other. And, you know, there may be things that are a challenge to one that are actually an opportunity for another kind of community. And one of the things I think is a challenge to be overcome, certainly here in Alberta and far beyond, is that we have these growing sense, I think, in some quarters that rural and urban opportunity are pitted against each other. And I would really love to see that conversation change to one of mutual opportunity. Just by way of, to give it a really concrete example, one of the most enlightening events that I ever got invited to speak at was a Rural Futures Conference sponsored by the Alberta government in Tabor. And I was unaware that there were these old networks of rural electrification programs that dated way back to the Depression era, where first bringing electricity to rural places. But one of the things I found, because I was talking a lot about renewable energy and the opportunities there, was that you had a ready-made network in Alberta to bring large-scale deployment of renewable energy. You have these old communication and support networks for rural electricity that would be fantastic to reactivate as renewable energy advocates and renewable energy implementation system operators. So I think we need to be exploring the connections more and not thinking to ourselves as much, maybe, that that's an urban problem, that's a rural problem. They are all problems that we share. And particularly, even if it wasn't already clear, particularly given that the climate challenge affects us all regardless of where we live and affects us randomly and without warning and does not care where you happen to be. I think we saw that, for example, with the flooding in southern Alberta this year. It was just as there was no urban or rural, there was no you know, us, them. We were all, I think, recognizing together how fragile we are in the face of a more volatile climate. And we'll leave it at that then. All right. Thank you again.